I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. Cars have come a long way. For more than 100 years now, these horseless carriages, as they used to call them, have taken us from point A to point B, and they've grown more powerful every year. Mr. Ford and Mr. Chrysler may have gotten the party started at the turn of the century, but about 50 years later, Mr. Honda and Mr. Toyota came in to really shake things up, putting Japanese car manufacturers on the map. Since the 1950s, Honda and Toyota have made quite the names for themselves in the United States and around the world. It's easy to see why. Their models are practical, affordable, and seem to last forever, making them a popular choice for the middle-class family vehicle. But can these brands last on reputation alone? Well, the reality is our relationship to our cars is changing. Rising gas prices and inventory shortages have folks rethinking whether they really need to get behind the wheel in the first place. At the same time, electric vehicle sales are booming, but Toyota and Honda have sat idling next to competitors who seem fully charged and ready to go. Here to help us understand where all this is headed is Wall Street Journal Autos editor Christina Rogers. She's covered the industry for more than a decade, interviewing leaders from the world's top auto manufacturers. We'll look at Toyota and Honda today and check out what's on the horizon in the years to come. All that's just ahead.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. Christina Rogers, welcome to Business Wars.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. I have a little bit of a theory, and it gets to why people are so car crazy, at least in America. And that is that, in a way, I think cars, a lot of us see cars as kind of an extension of ourselves, in a sense. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. They're like this mixture of like an appliance, a status symbol, you know, kind of part of your personality, and not to mention you spend a lot of time in them.
Well, you know, given that we're talking about how they're an extension of ourselves, is there a car you would consider to be your favorite or your best or or one that, you know, maybe you've had one that you just loved, adored, and you wish you could have it back? Or what, do you have one of those?
I have a couple, actually. Yeah. One of my first cars is a Jeep Cherokee. And I just, you know, the original one, I think it was in 89.
Oh, with the wood paneling on the side and all of that?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it was just such a classic. And there's so many memories in that, you know, it was the first kind of real SUV. So you could pack a lot of people in it.
Yeah.
So just remember packing all my friends in it.
Nostalgia. I mean, that's a huge driver in a lot of this, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, certainly. There is a ton of nostalgia. I mean, everyone kind of remembers their first car.
But you said there was more than just one that was special to you.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, there was the Mazda 3. It was a little compact car. I just loved the design, still do. And I am very much in love with my car right now. I have an Audi A4.
Ooh, nice. What is it that you like about that A4?
Oh, I remember seeing it at a car show and just, I thought it was just gorgeous. I think Audis, just, I love how they drive. They're like butter. They're so smooth.
Now, I have to ask you, you mentioned the Mazda, which I agree. I think it's not just an appliance, as you put it, you know, where you get from point A to point B, but it's a zippy car. I mean, it feels like it's designed to be a driver's car. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it definitely lives up to the zoom, zoom.
Zoom, zoom.
yeah. I mean, actually, our other car is a Mazda. It's a big SUV. But one of the reasons why we decided to go with Mazda is because even though it's a big SUV, it's still got that like zoom, zoom and like the real tight handling.
You know, I've never understood why it is that Mazda isn't thought of in the same way that, say, the two stars of our series, you know, Toyota and Honda. They're not, Mazda's always sort of taken a back seat to it, even though arguably the Mazda is much more sort of driver focused, whereas Toyotas and Hondas seem to be much more in that spectrum, much more of an appliance. What do you think?
I actually find that kind of baffling as well, because I think Mazdas are very good looking. They're very sporty. Price point's pretty similar. I don't know. Maybe they have a smaller footprint in terms of dealerships in the United States, and that might be it.
Well, maybe this gets to the history of it. I mean, because Toyota and Honda both very much pioneers when it came to introducing Japanese cars on American highways, right?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a lot in the brand recognition. I mean, both Toyota and Honda, they're just so well known for their quality, their reliability, and they were early here. So, I mean, I think that has some of it. You know, it's just hard. It takes a lot for someone to say, oh, I've owned a bunch of Toyotas, I'm going to try out a Mazda, you know, to make that leap.
Where are Toyota and Honda today? I mean, obviously, two of the biggest brands and certainly tons of brand recognition. And as we've been exploring, I mean, a real rivalry over the years. Who's in first and who's in second?
Well, I would say I think you've got to kind of look at things like a little bit pre-pandemic and during the pandemic. But pre-pandemic, I mean, those two brands, if anything, are steady. During the pandemic, you know, things just went haywire. I mean, big thing that we saw is big part shortages. And, you know, a lot of times you hear about semiconductors. That was certainly, that was and continues to be a big problem for the industry.
Yeah, this is the famous chip shortage you're talking about.
The chip shortage, yes. But other parts, especially in the early days of the pandemic, it was just really hard to get your hands on certain parts. Computer chips were a big one, but, you know, we had production lines going down right and left. And so the companies that were able to kind of work around the part shortages better than others, they started like picking up market share, coming ahead. Those like GM and Ford, you know, they really were having trouble, and you could see like their sales were dropping, and that's just because they didn't have cars.
Yeah. And in fact, what
SUVs to sell, you know?
And what they did have were just parked, you know, in huge parking lots because they were waiting for chips to arrive or parts to arrive because of the, you know, supply chain.
Yes. You know, you'd see these aerial shots of like parking lots outside of like racetracks and like football fields and outside the plants, right. Like just right. Filled with trucks, just waiting for like, you know, one or two parts so they could be shipped to the dealer. But the companies that were able to kind of work around those, keep building, keep delivering their cars to dealerships and keep selling them, you know, they fared better through the pandemic. And, you know, among those was Toyota. They picked up a lot of market share during the pandemic. And at one point they outsold GM. So they became the number one car seller in the United States for the first time. That's since flipped back. Honda during the pandemic, they had a little bit of a rougher go. I mean, I think between the two of them, it's been always pretty steady. Again, like we're in really, really unprecedented times now in the car market.
Right.
It's hard to say how long this is going to last. You know, when you talk to Toyota about beating GM, they're very humble about it. They're like, yeah, but that was just a quirk.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's
they're very humble about it. Meanwhile, if it was Ford overtaking GM, they'd be pretty happy.
Oh, yeah. They'd be honking their horns.
Yes.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's one other aspect to this Toyota-Honda divide. Both of these brands are household names, but of course, you know, you don't have to wind back the clock too much to see, you know, it just wasn't always that way. I mean, imported cars in the States really didn't start catching on until about 50 years ago. Once upon a time, and this was a big part of the car culture narrative in the United States, Americans loved their big cars with V8 engines, and, you know, bigger was better. But things changed. And, you know, when Toyota was introduced in this country, it was considered flat out too small, something that Americans just couldn't imagine themselves, couldn't picture a family in a Honda once upon a time. How did the import market change the game for American consumers, do you think?
The turning point really, I think, was in the 1970s. You know, you had kind of the Arab embargo on oil. That was around the time when the government, I think that those were the first fuel economy regulations came into play. I think it was like the mid 70s.
The CAFE standards, yeah.
CAFE standards, yep. You speak the lingo.
Corporate average fuel economy was what I think that stood for. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And so I think that like fuel economy, you know, up until that point wasn't really, really something on your shopping list. And then all of a sudden, you know, it became kind of like was on the minds of a lot of consumers. And that's where those two brands excelled. And not only that, I mean, like the quality, the reliability, it just so stood out with those two. I mean, I know the Detroit companies like really, really like recognized that, tried to learn from it. And, you know, really change the industry.
You know, you're making an interesting point because on the one hand, you can clearly see how government intervention sort of changed the game and opened up some doors for Toyota versus Honda. But you're based in Detroit and you know how attitudes change. Detroit for a long time dragged its heels on increasing fuel efficiency because they said you just can't do it. Toyota and Honda showed you can, and you can sell even in America. I mean, this had to have been in the long haul a good thing, not just for Toyota and Honda, but for American car makers too.
Yeah. I mean, over time it was. And here's my kind of understanding of things. Like at first, when some of those new fuel economy regulations came online, I mean, the Detroit car makers had to like rush out to put out smaller cars, to downsize engines, and they just really put out some crummy cars. In contrast, that really elevated Honda and Toyota.
Well, the Chevy Citation, that's all you need to say.
Chevy Citation is compact enough to fit into 3/4 of a parking space and offer gas mileage estimates you'd expect from a smaller car.
Chevrolet Citation, right? I mean, some of these things are, yeah, sort of legendarily
yes.
bad, I suppose you could say.
Yes.
And by comparison, Toyota and Honda were reliable, efficient, and just a lot cooler, ultimately.
Yes. Yeah. And I think just like, and over time, I mean, I don't know, you can argue whether the Detroit companies really caught up on small cars. They had their moments, but really it was, you know, those two companies, the Toyota and Honda, who owned that market.
But they also did something when it came down to reliability, dependability, quality control. I mean,
yep.
there were Detroit executives visiting Japan. Visiting the factories,
yeah.
trying to find out what was it that the Japanese were getting right, especially folks at Toyota and Honda. You think U.S. automakers have regained the ground that they lost in the 70s and 80s to foreign car makers? But nowadays, I have a sense that Detroit's caught up a good bit of what they lost back in the 70s and 80s.
In market share, no, they have not caught up. I mean, or regained ground. After the Japanese really kind of like made a push here, you could just see the market share of the Detroit 3 slide. I mean, I think that like eventually they caught up on how to make, you know, a reasonable small car. If you look at the JD Power quality study, the reliability studies, like it's always like the Japanese kind of at the top. And now, more recently, Hyundai, Kia are ranking higher.
Christina Rogers is our guest. She's autos editor for the Wall Street Journal. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about how these companies are or aren't keeping up with the EV trend. Stay with us. You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. Hey, welcome back to Business Wars. Our guest is Christina Rogers. She's autos editor for the Wall Street Journal. And recently, her team has been following Toyota's plans for electric vehicles since, well, they've been somewhat late to the game, despite being early to the party with hybrids. You know, Christina, I remember back when Toyota seemed to be leading the charge, pun intended, with the Prius, right? Here's one of their early commercials.
It's been a long time since transportation has truly advanced. We've been moving, we just haven't been moving forward.
You know, when the Prius was introduced, I mean, it was very different, very groundbreaking at the time. Do you remember when the car launched?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Late 90s, right?
Yeah. Wasn't quite the looker, I will tell you that, but it just like, it was so, but, you know, it was so distinct. And, you know, and I remember it being like kind of the status symbol, like, you know, all these celebrities and Hollywood driving around Priuses. And
I remember too, South Park had a little episode in which someone was driving a Toyota Prius, right?
That
was
what it said. I remember that.
Now there goes the new high and mighty Gerald Broflowski. Yeah, ever since he got that new hybrid, he thinks he's better than everyone else.
And in a way, again, we're talking about perceptions here. There was something about, okay, I'm saving the world and I'm driving my way to a better place. But I'm curious, why the Prius seemed to have such staying power, especially as other car makers sort of started jumping on the hybrid, dare I say, bandwagon?
Yeah. I mean, yes, there were other hybrids, but like, I feel like Toyota really committed to it. You know, they committed to that model. They really promoted it. I think like a lot of other companies, like, yeah, they did hybrids, but they weren't really like, you know, really hyping them.
They didn't seem to be as invested or something like that.
Yeah. And they, a lot of them were kind of just variants of other, you know, traditional gasoline nameplates. So, no, the Prius was like really unique in that, like, it was the first, like, kind of, you know, hybrid model with a capital H. I would say that like the auto industry in general has kind of had this wishy-washiness towards these electrified vehicles for a long time. I mean, now, you know, you hear all the companies are like really fully committed. It's an electric future. We're going all electric. We're going to get rid of our gasoline vehicles. But that's just like only recently. And I think Toyota in a lot of ways stood out because they made that commitment to the hybrid and they pioneered it. And they really kind of stuck with like advertising it and, you know, kind of updating it, building out into its own kind of like family of vehicles too.
Christina, riddle me this then. Why is it that Toyota, which was a leader in this, you know, hybrid shift, they don't seem to be all in when it comes to cars or trucks that are all electric? What's going on there?
You know, at first glance, it feels that way. And certainly their executives get a lot of questions. I think maybe it's more of a nuanced answer. Not long ago, we had a chance to interview Akio Toyoda, who is the head of Toyota. Mm-hmm. And he was just peppered with questions from journalists about why aren't you more committed about EVs? And basically, from what I understand, it's like, it's not that they aren't committed to EVs. They are working on EVs. They are putting money to it. It's just that they believe that, you know, hybrids are going to be kind of this like important bridge in kind of bringing consumers into the EV world. And I think their perception is like colored a lot from like by who they are and their kind of global footprint and their scale. Like Toyota is one of the biggest automakers in the world. It's always, I mean, for a long time, it was number two. In 2001, it actually became the biggest automaker by sales, overtaking VW. But because it's so big and it sells in so many markets, and Akio is basically, his argument was like, look, we have to make vehicles for everybody. We can't just make vehicles for those people that seem, you know, live near charging stations or have the money to install charging stations at their homes. Like, we have to make vehicles for people in developing countries who might not even have access to electricity. And they should have a kind of a environmentally friendly option that works for them. You know, when we talked to Akio, he said he tried to liken Toyota to a department store in which the value of the brand comes not from it being, you know, telling consumers what they should buy and being very selective. It comes from them offering like a full menu or full selection of things and letting the consumer decide. You offer them the gasoline vehicle, you offer them the hybrid, you offer a plug-in hybrid, and then you offer a full electric. I also think that like some of it is that Toyota just was a little more conservative in their view about how quickly EVs will catch on.
Well, I was going to say, you know, California has already got this mandate that's going to take effect. What is it, 2035, I think, something like that, where you can't sell a non-EV, non-electric vehicle in the state. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, they've had mandates like that for some time. You know, there's other governments, including Japan, which is put targets on for phasing out gasoline vehicles in places like China. Like, you want to sell cars there, you're going to have EVs. Same in Europe. Like, the tailpipe emission standards are so much stricter that, like, you know, for a while, the reason a lot of these car companies like GM were investing so heavily in EVs was for places like China, where GM has, like, you know, huge exposure and quite a bit of market share. So, yes, the pressure is on. And I think that probably within the last year, Toyota's gotten a lot more aggressive on EVs. But I still think that they feel that hybrids are going to play an important role. And you know what? We don't know. They could be totally right. You know, GM, on the other hand, they're like, no hybrids. We're going full EVs. They just didn't think it was a useful step. And who knows? They might be right. We just, you know, you don't know.
Well, what are investors saying? I mean, when you look at how the marketplace seems to be responding to these two very different approaches, on the one hand, don't try to steer people towards something that they don't already want. And then you have companies like GM, as you were mentioning, you know, full speed ahead. It's going to be all electric and that's what we're going to do. Which narrative seems to be selling better?
The GM narrative. I mean, investors are just enamored with EVs. And a lot of it is the Tesla effect. You know, Wall Street's looking for the next Tesla.
Which, of course, raises the question, were it not for Tesla, would Detroit's Big Three have ever really made the shift, or would they have been dragging their feet like they were back in the 1970s when it came to, you know, fuel efficiency standards and that sort of thing?
No, I don't think that the automakers would have all rushed into EVs in the way they are right now if it weren't for Tesla, because it really was when Tesla's valuation popped that we started seeing other automakers take notice. That's not to say, would these car companies start investing in EVs? Yes, I think that was inevitable. That was happening. It's been happening for a long time. I just think that, like, Tesla was the accelerant. They started selling a lot of cars, like, they became very cool, and the other companies were looking at it and wanted a little bit of that.
You know, you know what's weird is that I saw the new Cadillac all-electric vehicle. I think it's called the Lyriq, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful vehicle. And so here you have one of the, well, used to call them the dinosaurs of Detroit, right? Coming out with this very futuristic all-electric vehicle. And I can't name a single Honda that is all-electric. Well, you know, it does sort of make you wonder, is there something that these big giants, Toyota and Honda, know that maybe Detroit doesn't? Or is Detroit thinking more too short term, which is ironic given that the very purpose of electric vehicles is to save the planet? If there's, you know, that's hardly a short term way of thinking. But got to wonder what's going on.
Well, I mean, GM was very early. They were the first major automaker that really committed to EVs. I think, for one, Honda is working with GM on EVs. So Honda's kind of like tied themselves. I mean, and as well as Sony. Honda's working with Sony on EVs as well. Like, I think you will start to see more EV models from Toyota. It's just that the development cycles in automotive are so long that even if you commit to something today, it might be like 4 years before that new model reaches a showroom. And I mean, Toyota just recently launched a new electric SUV. So it's not that they're, like, you know, too far behind. Like, all these companies only have, like, a, you know, handful of models that are electric. It's still very slow going, but there's way more electric vehicles on the market now than there was even, like, you know, a couple of years ago. So it's really happening.
It's really happening. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about other Japanese and South Korean automakers giving Honda and Toyota a run for their money. We're talking Kia, Hyundai, Nissan. Oh, my. We're covering it all, so stick around. We get support from Acura. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. We get support from Court. You know, the way people work is changing, and the workplace itself needs to change too. But what if flexibility wasn't just an option? With Court's flexible furniture solutions, you can create agile work environments that become your team's greatest advantage. Save capital with swing spaces, attract top talent with collaborative environments, and create connected spaces that employees will love. Flexibility is the future, and Court Furniture Rental helps you embrace it. Learn more at Court, that's CORT.com/office. Hey, welcome back. My guest is Christina Rogers, autos editor at the Wall Street Journal. Now let's talk competition. We mentioned Mazda earlier on. Nissan, I mean, you know, the 1,000-pound elephant in the room here. Subaru, Mitsubishi. Mitsubishi is a long-going industrial concern in Japan. Anybody, who do you see as giving Toyota and Honda the biggest run for their money?
Right now, Hyundai Kia.
I mean, really? We're talking South Korea here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those two brands have really, really, I mean, reinvented themselves in terms of quality, in terms of styling, in terms of technology. I mean, it's almost like they took the Japanese company's like formula and like improved upon it. They're offering really, really high quality, reliable cars that are just really good looking. I mean, they have some real head turners out right now that look premium materials, great tech. You can get all the latest tech and at price points that you're just like, this doesn't even make any sense. How could this actually cost this?
You think about Hyundai's new line, the Genesis, which basically they followed the blueprint of Toyota and Lexus. And the Genesis, I mean, that's a lot of people say it's on par with some of the best vehicles coming out of Europe, including Mercedes.
Yeah, I mean, the new Genesis, like I know I saw one in the wild, or what we call just on the street. You know, I saw one the other day and I just like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, that is so good looking. That's so pretty. And, you know, they really, really are getting a lot of notice. I don't know how they do it. That's something like we here at the Journal would love to investigate more. But it's just, you know, the whole package. And if you look at some models like the Telluride, I mean, they're consistently on the top of every list of, you know, best SUVs to buy. In the last several years, they've really come ahead. And you can see that in their market share, too. They're picking up market share pretty quickly.
Well, I know that Kia and Hyundai have done a lot of collaboration, certainly in recent years. But do you see a brand that is standing out to you as maybe the inheritor of the crown that that is Toyota today? I mean, is there a South Korean manufacturer perhaps, or maybe there's someone in Europe that I haven't thought of that might be well positioned to sort of become the next king?
I don't know. I mean, Toyota's just, it's so big. I mean, Hyundai, Kia, they're very much see themselves as like separate brands and separate companies. I mean, they still have like a long way to go to match Toyota. And it's just so hard to really, really upset the pecking order in automotive. You know, Toyota sells like 10 million vehicles a year globally. And Volkswagen is right up there. To catch up on that, that would be tough, you know? So it's kind of hard to say, like, who would be the next Toyota? I really think Toyota's still going to be Toyota for a long time.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Well, it certainly does. You know, in a lot of ways, I have to say that it seems like many of today's vehicles are more like, rolling computers than cars. What do you think that means for the future of the auto industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of shift to EVs opens the door for new entrants to come in because, you know, it's a different supply chain, it's a different technology. And so you have these new companies like, you know, Rivian and Lucid, and, you know, there's a bunch of Chinese EV startups coming in. And same with like cars becoming more like rolling computers. It again opens the door for new entrants who kind of have more expertise in that space to come in. You know, there's just long been talk about an Apple car.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, I mean, I think with any like technological shift, you're like really kind of like recasting the playing field. And that's a lot of what we're seeing here. That said, the auto industry is really hard to disrupt. And it's because like, you just cannot defy the gravity of like what goes into manufacturing a car. It's hard. It's really hard. I mean, you're basically trying to create something that goes down the road at like 80 to 100 miles an hour, needs to last for like 13, 15 years and be totally safe, like withstand
right.
like crashes. Like it's not like making a cell phone, you know? It's a really hard industry to disrupt. And, you know, in that respect, companies like GM and Toyota and Volkswagen really do have the advantage there. Elon Musk often talks about manufacturing hell. And that's just how hard it is. It's really hard to replicate what Toyota does so well. And we find that with a lot of the EV startups right now. Like, you know, Rivian has just launched their new electric trucks and SUVs, and it's been a really hard year for them, you know, like getting their manufacturing lines running. you know, it's just like a, yes, this move to kind of computers and software and the shift to EVs, it's just, it's really kind of changing things, but at the same time, it is still a car.
You know, we began our conversation by talking about, you know, sort of the perfect car and, you know, the things that we have fondest memories of and that sort of thing. And, you know, you look at gas prices being what they are today, inventory shortages weighing down on consumers. And, you know, it seems like a lot of younger consumers especially, well, they're waiting longer before they get their driver's license, right? I mean, some don't bother doing it at all. They just as soon get an Uber or a Lyft somewhere. I'm wondering, where do you think the car fits into the American imagination these days? I mean, it used to be, wasn't anything more sort of iconic than the 57 Chevy with the tail fins, right? I mean, it was just like, it was like an American diner. It had that kind of cachet, right? Is that forever gone? Or do you think that we are going to somehow, some way, come back to this idea of passion for the open road? And the car is a kind of a, not just a status symbol, but something that sort of says something about us in a broader sense culturally.
I think, you know, there was a time not long ago when autonomous vehicles had become the craze in the auto industry.
Yeah. Self-driving cars. Yeah.
Right. And everyone was talking about the end of car ownership, even auto executives. I mean, I remember Bill Ford, you know, kind of getting on stage and talking about how we got to prepare for a future where people might not, you know, buy and own cars in the way they do now.
I think any business only exists to make people's lives better, period. And at a certain point, shoving more vehicles into an urban environment isn't doing that.
Oh, I remember that speech. It was talking about Ford becoming a transportation company as opposed to, I remember this.
But in that time, you know, car sales also hit record highs and stayed pretty close to that record. They dipped a bit, but they stayed pretty close. During the pandemic, of course, sales, you know, took a big hit, but that's only because we didn't have supply. I mean, people are buying cars like crazy. You know, they're like, by far, the demand is outstripping the supply.
Even with prices being what they are right now.
Prices are at record levels. I've never seen them so high, both on used and new cars. Thankfully, that's coming down a bit, but still, we're at like a very elevated level. You see studies where households on average own more cars than they ever did before. You know, like the average household now owns like two and a half to three cars. And I think during the pandemic, a lot of people kind of moved to more rural areas or they moved out of cities. And of course, that also kind of drove another wave of demand for vehicles. So I get like, you know, like there are some pockets of the world where people are, you know, kind of giving up car ownership and going to public transportation and everything. But I just think that like everything, like these things don't happen as suddenly as we think they will. And, you know, I do think that like the car culture is still alive and well. I mean, look, I live in Detroit, where we don't really have the option. We do have public transportation, but people don't take it like they do in New York. And, you know, we are very much a car-centric culture, but I think a lot of places are like that still. And so to get back to your question, I do think that the automobile will still capture the imagination of many of Americans. And I'll leave you with this because I also have two teenagers. One of them, when she turned 16, I just assumed she wasn't really going to be interested in, you know, cars. She just doesn't seem to be interested in that kind of stuff, like status symbols or anything. But no, she wanted a Volkswagen Beetle. And she was very particular about it. And she loves her Volkswagen Beetle. So, and she got her driver's license right away. So I just feel like, is Americans' love affair with the automobile fading? Maybe in some pockets, but I don't know. There's a lot of like counterpoints to that. So we'll see.
Christina Rogers, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Big fan of your show.
Well, we're a big fan of what you do, too. Thanks so much for doing this. Christina Rogers is the autos editor for The Wall Street Journal. You can keep up to date with all her team's reporting at WSJ.com. Coming up next on the Best of Business Wars Daily, we're talking about corporate blunders at Meta, Peloton, and Uber, and how these companies recover or don't. From Wondery, this is episode 5 of Toyota versus Honda for Business Wars. I'm your host, David Brown. Kelly Kyle produced this episode. Our interview episode producer is Peter Arcuni. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Additional audio assistance by Sergio Enriquez. Dave Schilling is our producer. Our managing producers are Tanja Thigpen and Matt Gant. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louis. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.